thank you. And thanks, everyone, for a really provocative, interesting, stimulating week of discussion so far that has left me with a lot of things to figure out, first of all, and then to think about. So this is an interdisciplinary conference, so I thought it would be good to start by explaining my perspective and where I come from, which is from philosophy, like several of the other speakers this week. So to say a little bit more about my research in general, it concerns history and philosophy of physics. In particular, I've thought a lot about foundations of quantum field theory, particle physics questions. More generally, on the philosophy of science side, the things I'm thinking about right now as big issues are applicability of mathematics. Why is it that we've been so successful in applying mathematics, and all the ways we've seen this week, which are very, very clever, but also require some of the most advanced mathematics that we've been able to come up with. Why is that a successful approach in physics? And then today I'll talk a little bit about analogical reasoning. So one thing that's not on this list is discovering quantum gravity. So I think this is actually one of the reasons why philosophers can come in and perhaps be useful, because I'm bringing a different perspective. I don't have a professional investment in like trying to develop a theory of quantum gravity. So it makes me come from a perspective where I'm an outsider in that particular way. But what I'm going to talk about today are ways in which, even though I'm not making a guess about what the next theory is going to be, I don't really have actually much to say about where the cracks form in our current theories or what we need to do next. But I do have a pretty good understanding of where we've just been, right? So I do have a good understanding of the history, particularly the quantum field theory side, but then also and the conceptual and foundational issues there. So I see this is where I can come in and have something useful to say. I don't really have a particular recommendation about which route to go on, to quantum gravity people should take, but I think there's some interesting and worthwhile lessons that have been learned from the recent history of physics that can contribute to the bigger community level endeavor. Okay, so in that spirit, I thought it would be useful to think about some of the big picture history and philosophy of science questions, which have already been raised in the discussions and in the talks that we've had so far. Did I start it like 3 minutes ago?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm generous.
Yeah, that's fine. So one of the questions which has come up is, has it taken too long to find quantum gravity? So the question wrote, I think this is the first day's discussion, do we need to be patient? And what does being patient look like? I think is probably the more important question for the people in the room who do have a professional investment in trying to find a theory of quantum gravity. This is another issue that's come up. So we believe a paradigm shift is needed in the Kuhnian sense. So does this involve abandoning completely, in the way that Kuhn kind of recommends, our current best theories? So giving them up entirely, is there going to be some big discontinuous transition of some sort that happens? This is a big one that is, at a general level, I think been at the heart of a lot of the discussions we've been having. So the big question is, are there methods that can be used to make discoveries in physics? So first, to be clear, since methods is used in a different way in philosophy of science, what I have in mind here by a method is something very minimal, right? Just a strategy for producing models or theories that are pursuit worthy. So for example, worth testing experimentally as a candidate, or worth developing theoretically if there's theoretical work that needs to be done before you can even make contact, say, with any observations, or even maybe to figure out what the connection is with the previous best theories that we had.
So how about talking to philosophers? Would you consider that a method or not?
That's a great question. Maybe it's a meta method. Yeah. So the contrast I want to draw here is there's been a lot of what philosophers have talked about is methods in the context of confirmation or justification of theories, which is also a very important topic. But I'm shifting here. I don't want to be that ambitious to start with, right? In the context of discovery, we need new ideas. A lot of them are not going to work out. But what we do need, I think, is a selection, some sort of selection criteria or generation mechanisms for coming up with ideas that are at least worth trying. Right, so that's the minimal sense that I have in mind here for what counts as a method in the context of discovery. So, actually, we've already been talking to philosophers all week, so there's some ideas about what this might look like, right? So one idea that came up in Chris's talk is the idea of correspondence principles. There's a great paper that's old by Heinz Post that Chris cited in his talk from 1971 that's called something like correspondence invariants and heuristics, and then there's some other long title, but that has a whole bunch of ideas of, say, ask philosophers. So that's a whole bunch of ideas, of which this is the centerpiece idea. So to give you another concrete example of what a correspondence principle is, so the Lorentz transformations in the view over C goes to equals zero limit, go to the Galilean transformations. So that's doing more than just preserving the predictions of the previous theory in the successor theory. It's also preserving structure in a certain deeper sense. Okay, so that's the idea here, is that that's, of course, going from the direction of the successor to the predecessor. The correspondence principle idea is turn that around. Can you turn the arrow around and then use that idea that you're going to have to preserve something structural deep in of our current theories that's right in the next theory, is the idea. Okay, so that's one idea. The other idea is unification. So maybe this is particularly relevant in quantum gravity, where it is a unification project, right? And the reason why it's hard is because it's just not clear how to make the theories that we currently have, that we need GR and quantum field theory, how to bring them together in a way such that they're compatible, and clearly something's gonna have to give, right? So that's hard, but thinking about the next theory in terms of unification also gives you a certain very loose constraint on what kind of thing you're looking for. And then analogical reasoning, I'll talk about more. So I see this all over the place in what we've been talking about this week in all the talks, especially in the discussions. Often what comes up is, you're saying that two things are similar. How are they similar? Is that a relevant similarity that you're drawing between these two things? So here's just a couple I've picked. A black hole horizon is similar to the cosmological horizon. Again, you want to ask, similar how and why do you think that? Analog experiments. So there's an explicit case in which analogies are coming in. So that was Matt's talk earlier. As I'm going to go on to explain, I think analytic continuations are also we've seen lots of different examples, and different cases are going to be different in terms of how they're going to generate analogies. But basically, analytic continuation is one way of generating mathematical maps, which then can be read as analogical maps, right? And so then the question there is, what kind of similarity, if we can map two models to each other in this very nice mathematical way, are we getting between those two models? Okay, and then the fourth big picture question, which is important as well, is science is a community-based activity, as we can see very clearly from this week. And so there's a question of how to structure scientific communities to encourage diverse membership and diverse ideas. This is a bigger question that involves sociology and psychology and all sorts of empirical science, as well as history and philosophy. But to bring it back to the philosophy question, it's an epistemological question, right? So one of the reasons why it's important to think hard about how we socially structure scientific communities is so that we can produce better quality knowledge, right? Which is ultimately an epistemological kind of goal. So, of course, Derrida talked about this explicitly and led us through some valuable exercises in thinking about how we could do a better job of socially structuring our scientific communities. But that's another important theme here. Okay, so these are four big picture questions, which I think all of them are worth thinking about more. I'm going to narrow in on my time on two of them. And one of them is the analogical reasoning question, which I promised to talk about. But I think I also had ideas about this first question when we had that discussion. So I'm going to take the opportunity to talk about that as well. So so the two things in purple are things I'm going to talk about. The other two things are going to be in the back. Well, the second thing, I think, I don't even know what you do, right? So if you take seriously this idea that there's going to be such a sharp discontinuity that we have to abandon everything we have right now as theories, I don't even know what the next step is there, right? So maybe if you have ideas about that, that can come up in discussion, but that's going to kind of be set aside, and I'm going to try to pursue number three, right? So we're going to have to work with the theories that we have now. What are productive ways in which we can do that, given that we know that the target is going to be something that is quite different in certain ways from what we have right now, but there are going to have to be similarities because we don't know where to start if we don't start there. Okay, so has it taken too long to find quantum gravity? I'm sorry that that John's not here, but so has it taken too long to find quantum gravity? Do we need to be patient? I'm going to argue that we do need to be patient. And so then the important question is really, if we need to be patient, what does that look like? So we've had some good discussion of this already that I want to remind people of. So you need to be patient maybe on the experimental side and the theoretical side. So on the experimental side, the value of looking for discrepancies from theoretical predictions using precision tests is something that Adam has talked about and that Chris has talked about. And so for this, a really good illustration for historical purposes is the case of Newtonian gravity. And so George Smith and Howard Stein and Chris as well have done lots of good work on this, which is worth looking at. On the theoretical side, Karen, I think, gave us a good example of a way in which you can pay more attention to the theories that we have to look for anomalies there that might then be clues to what needs to change in the future. So Karen talked about singularities. And so the idea here was we should try to use current theories, and I think this is actually from one of her slides I wrote down, try to use current theories, general relativity and QFT, to model scenarios at the presumed limit of the applicability of these two theories. And then hopefully you're going to see how things break down at that point. Okay, so I'm going to add on the theoretical side another historical example that I think is worth thinking about. And this is an example of a historical development which took a really long time. And so this is the kind of long history in a few bullet points of classical mechanics. So I started with Newton. Of course, that's not the beginning of classical mechanics, but that might be the beginning of when you would plausibly think you were done, right? Where Newton publishes the important book, has unified in various important ways that we've already talked about, the ideas that came before. But the important point here is that classical mechanics was not done at that point, right? So then there's a whole other century of Euler and others attempting to, in various ways, apply the framework of Newtonian mechanics and related frameworks. Some people then kind of gave up and tried different things, and it was just not clear how you would do, how you'd handle difficult cases like fluids, right, for example. Then it became clear that gravity was in lots of ways a nice, ironically from Mark Kerr perspective, gravity was in a lot of ways a nice simple case where you had nice planets that were like point masses and everything was kind of nice. It was harder to deal with more complicated cases. So a lot of work on this. Lagrange comes in about 1800. And there's a history, there's already rational mechanics has been established at that point. Lagrange comes in and thinks about things in a more abstract mathematical way. He's not really thought about as doing physics at that point, which I think is very interesting, right? So there's a whole bunch of math that he goes off and does that makes contact with physical questions, but he doesn't even try to solve any physically relevant problems at that point, any physically realistic problems. That, again, takes another century to get to. Right. So if you think about Thompson and Tate coming later on, and then there's like after that, there's a whole big process that's been studied by historians of like thinking about electromagnetism and how electromagnetism fits in the framework of Lagrangian formalism is not actually straightforward at that point to figure out. Right. So the point here is just that these are significant developments that happen. They all take a long time. And here's the punchline for us. the value of history is we can look backwards and we know what happens next, right? So we know what happens next. What happens next is quantum theory. And surely what happens at the very end of this whole sequence is very important for quantum theory, as all the discussions we've had this week illustrate, right? You need Hamiltonian and Lagrangian mechanics. So then, by analogy, I think the question gets posed for quantum gravity. Is there further development of general relativity and quantum field theory of the theories themselves that's needed as input for theoretical development of quantum gravity? So I'm happy to this is two different parts of my talk that are kind of not related. So I'm happy to have a bit of discussion about this now. At the back, yeah.
Are you considering the number of people working on these topics?
So I don't really think that's relevant. I know Rob was going to probably ask the same question.
Yep.
So let me put it this way. I think what I see is important. I've cherry picked a certain things, and so there's a lot that's going on. I should say there's a lot of really good historical work that's just been done in the last few years on this very period, right? Because what was the thought by historians was that Kuhn was right, and then the revolution happens, and then you have the paradigm, and there's all this normal science activity which goes on to articulate the paradigm, but it's like dotting the I's and crossing the T's and not really contributing to our ontological understanding or theoretical understanding of what's going on. There's a better realization right now that that's actually not true in this case, certainly, right? Like by the time you get to the end, what you think classical mechanics is about, in fact, it's about a bunch of different things, right? It's a very complicated story. But back to the question about whether it makes a difference to have more people. Yeah, it makes a difference to have more people, but there's still a lot of work to be done, right? So maybe it's like I could give a different talk in which I try to guess where, like, say, quantum field theory is with respect to this. But maybe renormalization group methods are perturbative renormalizations like Newton. Maybe renormalization group methods are like some of the little bits of pieces that you get in the 1700s, but it doesn't really come together until later, right? That would be the way I'm thinking about this, is that there's potential room for further theoretical development here. So Rob was going to ask the same question that I just answered. So I'm going to, I saw Carlo and then Lee.
So who's first here?
Carlo was first and then Lee.
I have a comment, but I need a full minute. I don't know if you want to. Do you want me to postpone this to later?
Lee, go ahead.
You seem to underrate, or you don't mention the role of mistakes. That is, for example, Planck was completely wrong. Mm-hmm. Between standard statistical mechanics and radiation. In other words, he did not understand Boltzmann's work. It's crucial that Planck did not understand Boltzmann's work for Planck to have made the, quote, success of it.
Yeah.
I think that happens much more of the time. Because I think the development of science is much more chaotic and less rational. You seem to be doing a kind of rational reconstruction.
Yes, okay, good. So my next example is an example of an important mistake. Okay, so we can come back to this. People can think about this think about how this is right or wrong in the discussion period. Okay, so now I'm shifting to the second topic I want to talk about, which is analogical reasoning, which I think is a good example of a method for discovery in the limited sense that I was intending, right? So what we're looking for here is some sort of method by which we can generate a model or theory, or more limitedly, a hypothesis, which is then worth pursuing by testing or developing theoretically or whatever, right? So this is a toy example. It's not a historical example. It's to give you the idea of what thinking about analogies and what kinds of analogies get used in physics involves. My next example is the development of renormalization group methods, which is a historical example. Okay, so this is, you could think, okay, the wave equation gets applied in different domains. It seems like we can take advantage of the fact that we know now that it turns out to be a very powerful way of at least getting a first gloss on what's happening in a particular domain. So you might think, okay, we know about water waves by the time we get to the end of the 1800s. There's a finite speed of propagation. If we know that electromagnetism has a finite speed of propagation, maybe a way to model such a thing would be to use the wave equation. Okay, so where I have the green check marks, those are known facts at the time in history that the analogy is being introduced. So here, there's a couple of different ways in which you could push this analogy to electromagnetism, right, in this simple example, or optics, say, right, if you want a simple example. So one is just this question, can we use the wave equation to model optics or electromagnetism? And the second one is, okay, well, we noticed that water waves involve the displacement of some medium. Can we similarly interpret this equation in terms of the displacement of some medium? Okay, so this is nice, again, historically, because we know what happened. Well, this is fake, but we know what happened here, right? So one of them works out, and then Lee is saying the mistakes are important as well, right? So that's very, it turns out actually to be very important that there's no ether, right, to what happens later. So one hypothesis panned out, one did not. That's not a problem for the whole method, right? Because all I'm looking for here is something that's worth trying. So I think this meets the bar of using analogies in this way as something worth trying to come up with hypotheses that are pursuit-worthy in that sense. The point I want to make in this talk is that if you're trying to assess whether a particular analogy is useful in a particular context, then the first thing to think about is what kinds of similarities are relevant in the context in which you're trying to use the analogy. So this is an example in which the successful hypothesis, if we pick the wave equation, is supported by an analogy that's both formal and physical to the water wave source domain. So source and target. Source is where you have known physics that you're trying to use as a leverage to then learn something about the target domain, and that's how the analogies work. Okay, so the formal part is just, in this case, you have the wave equation, which is the same, or as you get more sophisticated, it's going to be similar, but not exactly the same mathematical equation. This generalizes in the case I'm going to talk about. You're not going to have the same equations in the renormalization group methods case, but you can track similarities in the form in the formal structures that you're using in a more abstract and general way. Second, I think this is important in this case, that ultimately, again, this is taking advantage of our hindsight view, you can see in retrospect, there's something that gets right, right? And the something that gets right is not just that you got the right math somehow, it's that there's a deeper physical similarity between water waves and electromagnetic waves. Stick into classical theory here, I'm not gonna get complicated and try to explain how this projects into future theories, but you get the causal structure in some sense right. Right, in an abstract sense, right? You're not right about ether, but you are right that there is some causal mechanism of propagation. So something, the water, the field strengths vary. Okay, so this is for a student, so this is like oscillates. It varies in the cycle in directions perpendicular to the direction in which the wave propagates. Okay, so this is an example of an analogy that is both formal and physical. What I want to put on the table here is methods change over the course of science. We're improving the methods in science as we are improving our content and our theories, right? So I think this is an interesting case in which you can see a clear shift in methods of analogical reasoning that are used between 19th century physics and 20th century, where you have lots of analogies being drawn between particle physics and condensed matter physics, right? And this persists, right? How much of this have we seen this week? So I think this is a very important, and we've gotten far enough in physics now that we know this is very successful, right? So spontaneous symmetry breaking is one of the other historical cases I've looked at quite carefully. This is a renormalization group case study. So these are all cases in which we don't know what to do in particle physics. We go and look at models that have been successful in condensed matter physics, and it goes in the other way as well, right? So after this story I'm going to tell here, then it goes back and thinking about universality in condensed matter physics from the particle physics points of view gets to be important. Lee.
Isn't it a great failure of this method that it doesn't apply to Lorentzian quantum?
I haven't told you what the method is yet.
Well,
so
it's connected to the renormalization.
So save that question, because I want to come back to that during the discussion period. Okay. So this, as I said, is a genuine historical example. So in one way, it's the perfect example to tell you about because as Lee was just gesturing to, this has come up all over the place this week. But it's important for my purposes that you try to take yourself back to physics circa 1970 in order to understand the situation that Wilson and collaborators were in at that time. So I know that, actually this has come up already, Carlo was mentioning about what it was like to be doing physics at this point before you have the important developments that happened in the first part of the 1970s in particle physics, and like the resurrection of field theory, right, as a paradigm for doing particle physics. So remember at this point, there is a fairly well worked out field theoretic model for electroweak interactions, at least QED, right? But there's a big question about how you treat strong interactions and particular, it's not even clear that field theory is going to be the right framework in which to be modeling strong interactions. Okay, so one term that's come up a lot of times this week is the Wilsonian renormalization group. So I want you to ban that term from your mind right now, because this is a very interesting story, but that is a development that starts about here, but all of the things that we now associate with the Wilsonian renormalization group, there's a lot, like, to get to effective field theories, that's like not till like later in the 70s, beginning of the 80s. So they don't know that at this point, right? Like, and it wouldn't be fair to expect them to know that. So don't think I'm talking about the Wilsonian renormalization group, because that has all sorts of connotations which are not yet discovered at this point in the history of physics. Okay, so what I'm going to pick here is a particular move that gets made. This is a review paper, long paper by Wilson and Kogut that gets published in 1974. It's called the renormalization group and the epsilon expansion. And so essentially what happens in this paper is earlier in the 1970s, just a few years before, the papers in which renormalization group methods get developed and applied successfully in to collective phenomena and condensed matter physics, to phase transitions and critical phenomena are published, like at least the first papers, right? And then Ken Wilson at this point is turning to think about taking the renormalization group method from the context of condensed matter physics to the context of quantum field theory. So essentially this is a formal analogy, a purely formal analogy that gets introduced for the purposes of taking this promising, at least at that point, set of mathematical formal techniques in condensed matter physics and transferring them to quantum field theory. Okay, so the source in this case is a very simple class. It's a variation of the classical statistical mechanical Ising model for a ferromagnet. And the target is also relatively simple, a QFT model for scalar phi-4 interactions. And the goal of this paper, and this is maybe where you're realizing how early this is, because the goal is to come up with first of all, you want an effective model for these 5-4 interactions. You want it to be renormalized, but it's going to be a continuum model, and that's actually important to the construction. Okay, so that might be something that later on people think about, but not here. Okay, so here's the picture of what's going on. So at the top on the left-hand side, we have this simple classical Ising model. So you have your lattice. And you have a spin field, which is on the lattice, so that you can have values +1 or -1, and you have correlation functions that you're wanting to calculate from your Ising model. And then this is on the source side, you've figured out at this point a model for taking the renormalization, using the renormalization group transformation to model critical phenomena when the limit of the correlation length is infinite, and that then eventually that gets applied to critical phenomena in all sorts of different contexts, but most immediately to the case of ferromagnets. So now we're starting to develop our formal analogy. On the other side here, what we have, and this is where I need my big stick. Okay, so if you squint, this is supposed to kind of, okay, so I don't know how to draw a quantum field, nobody does, that's another talk, but the so this is supposed to look kind of like, if you squint, what's happening over here, as far as a mathematical model is concerned. So I have my phi 4 quantum field theory, I've put it on a lattice, and then I have a field, so I should say, I'm gonna say on the next slide, what we're gonna do is Wick rotate these things in the next slide, so n is gonna be time over here, and m is going to be the spatial variables, and then we're going to be interested in calculating vacuum expectation values, and then this is going to be the part that is the point of introducing the formal analogy, right? That figuring out how to use renormalization group methods over here, how to get the continuum limit, because I've just, for the purpose of making things tractable to start, I've imposed a lattice structure over here. So I want to get rid of that at this stage. And what I'm wanting, of course, is going to be the effect of renormalized theory. So that's going to be at relatively low energy scales. OK, so let me step you through this. Quickly, as I was saying, I think this is another reason why it's a good, this is an interesting example to talk about, is because the first thing you do is you analytically continue in order to make a very, it's not just that you have some abstract or vague formal relationship between these two models, it's very precise that you use this Wick rotation, obviously, to analytically continue between these two models. Wick rotating, you have the correlation functions. This is the classical statistical mechanical side. And then you equate them up to this constant these are the propagate time ordered expectation values. So these are the propagators. So you have constants that come in to make this an equation. But you can see what you've done by interpreting this analytic continuation, Wick rotation as giving you an analogical map. So the spin field is the analog of the quantum field. Here's the key thing: you've Wick rotated, and then you're taking the space time that you have on the QFT side to the space side on the classical statistical mechanical system, and then the correlation functions you want to compute over here. You want to compute vacuum expectation values, or propagators in this case, over here. Okay, so I don't have time to go into this, but if you go back and read some of Ken Wilson's original papers, he has a very nice way of describing what's going on in terms that I think really emphasize that what's happening is a formal analogy between these two models. He talks in nice terms about how problems with an infinite number of variables are difficult to solve. Infinite number of degrees of freedom are difficult to solve. And so then he has this idea of statistical continuum limits being the formal piece that's analogous between these two models. Okay, so then we are also going to have to take limits to make this all work out. So so in the quantum field theory side, we want to get rid of the momentum cutoff that we put in artificially at the beginning, and that's going to correspond, not physically, but that's going to correspond in terms of this analogical mapping to taking the correlation length to infinity, or going to the critical point. Okay, so this is an adaptation of a diagram from that paper. So what I want to emphasize here is this is the effect of renormal Q. This is all on the space of dimensionless cutoff interactions from the classical statistical mechanics. But we can just we have the equation that we can use to identify this with the QFT space that we really care about. So here is the trick, is that you're taking this constraint curve So these on this orange line. And so we, of course, know that we want the renormalized mass to come out right for our 5-4 QFT. So what we do is we fix that. So that's going to be the same in all of these models. But then we can vary the, well, so this would usually be a lattice spacing cutoff in the statistical mechanical model, but we're going to do it in momentum space because that's what we care about for particle physics. So then we're going to impose that constraint along here. So these are all different, physically different theories in space. So, but then we're going to do it at each of these points. We can then use our renormalization group transformation to get up here an effective surface. The trick is, of course, that if you assume that you have a fixed point that exists, which we're assuming because it's still 1974, right? That once you get down to the critical surface here, you can, by taking a limit of all these theories, which are all effectively equivalent at this low energy scale, then you can, by taking this limit, get to Q infinity. So the trick, the result that's important here is showing that this exists. Okay, which is why you need the classical statistical mechanical model in the first place.
What is Q infinity?
So this is the effective. So this is the so if you take this out of the classical statistical mechanical space, this is going to be the continuum effective renormalized 5-4 theory in the QFT that you were looking for at the beginning. Okay, so let me get back to formal analogies here and say what I think we're learning in this case. So what we're learning in this case, so again, I have the green check marks are supposed to be the things we know over on the Ising model side, the things we know over how we set up our 5-4 model. Here, I think, is what we're learning here. Of course, we get the thing I had in the red bubble at the end, which is the 5-4 model, but it's key here we get more than that, right? As I said earlier, I think really what you're doing here is you're getting, you have renormalization group methods and these and the limits, which work in concert in the Ising model case, condensed matter case. You're figuring out how to do formally the same thing on the QFT side. Okay, so you're not just getting a model for a particular 5-4 case, which you might not even care about. But you're getting this model construction, mathematical model construction procedure, right? And so I think that's why, in this case, the mathematical analogy, the formal analogy, is what was needed. And furthermore, I think, I'm going to skip down to here. Furthermore, I think that it's fairly clear in this case that you don't really care about the physical disanalogies between the condensed matter system and the QFT system. Robert, yes?
Yeah, maybe confused because in the example that you are talking about, the lambda 5-4 model does not exist. It's trivial.
Right.
You come to that.
So I think that's why it's important that it's 1974.
That's why I'm
right. Yeah, so, right, so, right, so, okay, so this is something I don't have on this slide, but I think that whenever you come to this point and you get this, in this case, this construction procedure that you've gotten by analogy, then I think one thing that you should do to take it seriously is you should try, you need to, obviously, that's an assumption that went into it. So you need to check that assumption for different dimensions of space-time, right? Whether the fixed point that you're assuming exists actually exists. So that's one thing you would do to theoretically pursue this model. So you would learn something there. But I think right, so you should try to construct models for other QFTs using similar kinds of procedures. And then you can experimentally tell, well, if you thought that there were, this is all at a very abstract mathematical model building level, the next step to even try to test this thing would be to find a concrete system that you think is well described by the model that you've come up with by analogy. But then I think that's something else that you could do. But yeah, so you're right. So I think that this is a way of getting a candidate model that's worth, and model construction technique that's worth then pursuing. We know it's worth pursuing, right, in other cases. Okay, so let me skip to the moral for the people in this room. So the moral for methodology of discovery, I think, is that purely formal analogies can be useful heuristics for particular purposes. And I've shown you one purpose. The one purpose I've shown you is for the purpose of obtaining new model construction strategies, which have a kind of mathematical flavor from a certain set of mostly mathematical modeling assumptions that you start with. So the cautionary note here, though, is I said, I don't really care whether the condensed matter system is physically similar in the physics to what to the quantum field theory system, but then you can't have your cake and eat it too. So you have to be careful once you do use this formal analogy to come up with a model. You can't then think, okay, so what I have is basically a magnet, and basically QFT, basically particle physics is just the same as the physics of magnets. That's not true at all. Right, so you're going to need to physically reinterpret the model you get at the end. This is very important. Okay, now I'm finishing. Conclusions, number one, that I've given people time to think about. The long history of classical mechanics suggests that development of theories can take a long time, and that refined formulations of theories can be important inputs to successor theories. And I gave you Hamiltonian Lagrangian mechanics. So then, putting the question to quantum gravity, is further theoretical development of general relativity and QFT needed as input for theoretical development of quantum gravity? Secondly, this is a big topic, analogical reasoning as a method for discovery. So I think one thing that's worth thinking about when you're thinking about how you're coming up with your hypotheses and models is, what do I want to achieve, and what kind of analogy do I need to achieve what I want to achieve? So I've stressed that purely formal analogies that are just mathematical can have a role to play, I think, in proposing new models. So that's the second example here. So purely formal analogies are relevant, I think, when the obstacle to progress is inability to infer predictions from hypothesized theoretical principles. So this is how I think of the case of maybe like the strong interactions, or like the limitations we had on trying to get from quantum field theory to concrete models that were able to make predictions back circa 1970. Okay, so there could be reasons of incalculational intractability, or just like you don't know how to make a concrete model, even though you have really good theoretical starting point, you think. Okay, so But I also don't want people to stop thinking about physical analogies. Okay, it's not an either-or situation. You have to pick one and go with it. It's going to depend on what you're trying to do. So if what you're interested in is gaps in our understanding of the physics, then just looking at the math is not going to be enough. You need to think more carefully about the question I set aside, which is, for example, how are condensed matter physics systems similar to whatever kind of gravity quantum system you're interested in? Okay, and then the ultimate question is, are both types of obstacles standing in the way of quantum gravity?
Thank you.
So I don't necessarily want to take Lee's time. I'll be around all day if people want to.
I think maybe we take questions? 5 minutes of questions.
Okay.
Okay, so very tough decision, but okay. So I think Rob was
okay.
Discriminated against previously.
Oh, by fielding my own questions. Okay.
Man, I can change. I have to.
Okay.
So I mean, you know what I'm gonna say about first. I think the number of people is very important, and I would contend there's been enormous theoretical development in multiple directions. Mm-hmm. So I think what's frustrating the community is that none of these developments are working all that well, though their practitioners in particular areas would contend otherwise.
But so can I just, yeah, so I think
I have another one about part two, but okay, go ahead.
I'm just going to say one sentence. Euler would have been frustrated too. Like, if you lived in the 1700s, like, would that, like, I mean, there was things he's trying to do and he wasn't successful doing them either. So, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but Euler was one of the very few number of people relative to today. So anyway, but the other about number two, like, while I agree with the moral, I can't help but wondering what the ratio of success to failure is, because there's lots of people that all the time produce analogies all over the place, many of them sending private emails to me, and I'm sure many others say, you know, I've got this new theory, and they're basing it on some kind of analogical reasoning, but they're wrong. So, I mean, I would say this is going on all the time, both at the extreme, what some call crackpot level, but also in the level of very serious science. But again, the frustration is it's not working. So my net conclusion is this is an enormously difficult problem, perhaps even too difficult for any human mind or collection thereof. Well, would you say that is a reasonable possibility?
So I said at the beginning, I'm not in the business of trying to guess theory, like come up with new theories of quantum gravity. So that would be a pessimistic take on where we're at, obviously. I think that I haven't given you enough, as you're pointing out here, I'm pointing out there's two different types of analogies that you could find relevant depending on what kind of situation. But as you point out, you need to know a whole lot more about this to figure out whether, if you come up with a candidate physical analogy, whether that's even worth thinking about or not, right? So there's no getting away from needing to know a lot about the theories we already have, right? Which is maybe about the first point. So I wish I had a crystal ball and could like look into the future and see what was going to happen. But I think maybe this is a point where some of the foundational work that's been done in physics and in philosophy might then be come in to think harder about what are the going to be the relevant physical and formal analogies. So, but I agree, you can have the things are like there's infinitely number of ways in which any two things are similar, right? So just saying find ways in which things are similar. I mean, maybe now we're talking about machine learning or something or AI, but so that's not going to help you. Just have that as your heuristic. So this is not the end solution. I'm just hoping to get, so I think often in the history of physics, the physical analogies have been the things that have been received a lot of attention. I think it's worth thinking about the mathematical ones too. And that's what I want to push here.
So we have to move on, but just maybe one quick comment or question by Carlo.
Yeah, a couple. First comment.
Just one, whichever.
Okay, so I'll go to the second, which about your first point. I think that you pose a question at a certain point whether a radical shift is needed, and then a second question immediately after whether this would mean abandoning, changing previous theories. And I want to emphasize the fact that these two questions are completely independent. And the answer can easily be yes to the first, no to the second.
Yeah.
And I think this is something we often forget. And it's easy to list historical cases in which a radical change of perspective, new ideas, came not from abandoning previous theories, but the other way around, to take seriously previous theories and to somehow extract the core of them, as you said. And this is related to your question whether general quantum theory needs to be sort of a further theoretical development, as you put it. I'm with Rob that a lot is happening. I mean, we think about GR, we just think about Hamiltonian analysis of GR has completely changed the way we think about it with respect to 30 years ago. But I specify what happened to quantum field theory, and this is where I want to get at. I think we already had this kind of, when you say quantum field theory, I think there is an ambiguity in talking about quantum field theory. Because quantum field theory means two different things. It means a quantum theory for a system with an infinite number of degrees of freedom, and a very wide notion of quantum theory. And then there is a very specific notion of quantum field theory, which is the local quantum field theories which are built on. So I think it's misleading to think of GR and quantum field theory, and it's more useful to think of GR and quantum mechanics, because the actual quantum field theory we have, it's just a specific example of a quantum mechanics for a infinite dimensional, for a system with an infinite dimensional, with an infinite number of degrees of freedom. So it seems to me that everything we know from all the tentative theories of quantum relativity we have, because we have quantum identity theories, several, tell us that quantum field theory in the restrict sense, of course, has to be thrown away, but quantum field theory in the large sense of quantum mechanics with an infinite number of degrees of freedom doesn't need a deep rethinking for combining with an appropriate way of doing GR.
Okay, so very quickly, I guess this is the point to advertise a great conference that's happening next week, of which the talks will mostly be on YouTube, right? So Chris is organized at Western next week. There's going to be a philosophy of QFT conference, which is going to talk about a lot of those issues. But so here's like thinking about your talk, Carlo, and about the important role that the truncations played in this whole setup of loop quantum gravity. So maybe the question I would put back to you, which you're not going to have a chance to answer right now, is that. Yeah. So is okay. So like I think it's kind of difficult sometimes to tell whether when we run up against obstacles in theoretically formulating particular theories like relativistic QFT, which is what I had in mind here. Is it because there's like calculational mathematical problems we haven't solved yet? Or is it because there's some sort of deep physics that we're learning from those types of obstacles? And I think it's hard to tell. I'm pushing against accepting the truncations that there would be another way of pursuing these developments, which would look more carefully at like mathematical aspects of relativistic QFT. But again, this is a community doing this work with lots of sub-communities that should be maximizing the number of different plausible directions in which to pursue this research.
So. And that note, let's thank Doreen again.